position number 11127, reel 5.
Well, the upshot of this was that General Walter Walker, who was commanding in Borneo, confirmed that he would like to see me and discuss a possible role for the SAS. And I arrived in Brunei some 3 weeks, I think, after the outbreak of the revolt. I saw General Walter, and he thought it would be useful to have a parachute trained force as a force reserve, which could be parachuted into any of the many remote locations in Borneo should they be seized by rebels. And I, careful not to pour too much cold water on such an idea, I did suggest to him that probably our most useful role would be to operate in two-man parties with our radio equipment. This equipment was new, and as far as I know, General Walter Walker didn't at the time know how we were equipped or what our capabilities were. And I was able to explain to him, and he was always a very good listener amongst his other many virtues. And when he had assessed what I told him, he decided that perhaps the best role for us would be to put parties of two men, one of whom would speak Malay, with a radio set which could communicate from the frontier areas back to his headquarters. And it was really on that basis that he asked for one of the only two SAS squadrons that then existed, they having been cut back after the Malayan War from four squadrons to two squadrons. And he asked for a squadron to come out, which it duly did a week or two later.
Did you come out with them? Did you go out with them
or? I stayed out there, sent a signal back, and called a squadron out, and then discussed the whole operation while the squadron commander got on with deploying the squadron. I was really the contact man, so to speak, both with the general and also very much with Tom Harrison, who at the time was curator of Kuching Museum, but was the authority on the tribes in the interior, and who had the further major advantage that he had worked with them in the Second World War against the Japanese. And he was absolutely invaluable, because it was through his, so to speak, introduction to the tribes, that the fact that Tom Harrison said that these SAS chaps were okay, you can work with them and trust them, was really our entree and an enormous asset, because we didn't have to start totally from scratch as with the Aborigines. We came in as, in effect, friends of Tom Harrison, and so we had a head start. And the fact that by then many of the NCOs in particular could speak Malay meant that we immediately established relations with the tribes in the interior, who were intensely loyal to Great Britain. At the time, didn't really have much concept of Malaysia, but they were loyal to the British Crown. It was not uncommon, even in longhouses, to see photographs of King Edward VII and George V, though not quite so many of Elizabeth
II. This is this business about the camping in the bottom of his garden. What is that all about?
Once we had troops in Sarawak as well as in Brunei, he was kind enough to let us have a squadron headquarters in his garden, because it was always difficult to find accommodation. And for a short time, we had a squadron headquarters, I think it was, in Tom Harrison's garden in Kuching. It was rather disconcerting, because you were liable to meet an orangutan or something like that leering at you over your breakfast.
And presumably Ivan's coming in. Presumably Ivan's swapping in there.
Yes, of course.
I sort of had this sort of image of him sitting there with all these Ivans.
After the initial deployment in January and February 1963 of the SAS in these two-man patrols along the frontier, Things were pretty quiet on the military front for a time, and this was one of the phases when I thought, oh, well, this will all be over. And I spent quite a lot of time back in England planning exercises in Germany and elsewhere for later that year, and all the time expecting to be told that the whole thing was going to fold up in Borneo and we could all come home. However, it didn't, and very slowly during 1963, Indonesian military activity increased. And so, though initially we had merely established intelligence gathering posts along the frontier where we collected information from the local tribes in the interior, they were 100% supportive of the British, and we got information freely from them of Indonesian movements. But we had to start extending this because not all the frontier, of course, was inhabited. Indeed, most of it was uninhabited. And it is 900 miles in length, you know, the frontier with the Indonesian Borneo. So we had to consider covering the areas which were uninhabited, and we did this by sending small patrols inside the frontier, with the task of intercepting the tracks of Indonesian raiding parties. And in jungle it's very easy to see parties of 20, 30, 40 men if they march through jungle. The human tracks are quite impossible to erase, and so we patrol parallel and inside our frontiers to pick up tracks. And in fact, this paid off on one occasion in 1963 in front of the Royal Leicesters, where we picked up the track of a party of invading terrorists. The Royal Leicesters were then directed further inland to intercept, which they did most successfully. And at the time, the Minister for War was on a visit, who I think at the time was Mr. Ramsden, and he happened to be out just after this action, and I think this was probably of considerable help in establishing at the higher levels at home in the armed forces that the SAS were playing a useful role. And we only had two squadrons at the time, and we were now severely stretched because General Walker would have liked to have more SAS troops to cover the frontier. And it was sometime during the summer of 1963 that, thanks perhaps mainly to General Walker, who kept saying how useful the SAS were to him in this theatre, and also, of course, to ourselves for explaining how difficult we were finding it with just two squadrons to keep up a presence in Borneo, as well as train for other roles we had in other parts of the world. And sometime in 63, the decision was made that we should be authorized to recruit again, in fact, re-raise the 3rd SAS Squadron. And by the end of 1963 and into 1964, the position became rather more serious because the Indonesians stepped up operations on the frontier. And the Director of Operations, General Walker, considered various methods whereby which we might use to defeat this, and one of the methods for discussion which I had with General Walker was in what ways the SAS might more effectively defeat this in Indonesian operation. And the obvious and very simple way was that instead of remaining on the defensive and having to react to Indonesian raids the whole time from bases where they sat quite secure on their own side of the frontier while we were harassed on our side of the frontier, the obvious answer was to carry the war across the frontier to them. Obviously, politically, this had to be approved by the British government at home. What factors they took into account, of course, I don't know, but one of the factors that was quite obvious to us was that there was no access to correspondence from the media on the Indonesian side of the frontier. And though we gave access to correspondence on our side of the frontier, It appeared on the face of it that any action we took against the Indonesians across the frontier might not be reported by them because they might not wish to acknowledge that there were raids across the frontier. Equally, it was possible, of course, that they might say that we were invading Indonesia. Anyway, the decision, political decision, was taken that very limited raids across the frontier would be carried out.
Just before we get
to tell you why, you ask whether we had ever crossed the frontier before. The short answer is yes, we had crossed the frontier before, but it was a genuine mistake, and it was not a deliberate action. I expect it's equally obvious that there were many in the SAS who said to me, "Colonel, why on earth can't we go across and hammer those bastards the other side? We'd really make them sit up." And of course, I was conscious too that if I took in the slightest way an ambiguous line on this, that one of my enterprising young officers would be only too pleased to do a sort of Jameson raid. And the results, I was quick to stress to them that whatever they might think, or I might think, about the folly of not going across the frontier, it was absolutely essential that we did not cross the frontier and that none of them crossed the frontier. Because if the SAS, in these days when we were still far from well established, took it into its own hands to carry out an action which to everybody in the regiment quite obviously had political implication, we would never be trusted again with anything else. And I did hammer home, because I was certainly aware of the possibility that some young man might decide to take the law into his own hands, so to speak, and I stressed to them that such an action could be quite fatal to the whole regiment. And there was never any crossing the frontier by the SAS at all until it was authorised by the government. My experience with the press first started when I was an intelligence staff officer in 1949 in Hong Kong, where the army at the time used to use me, really, to take round parties from not only the British press but the American and other international press around Hong Kong when it was very much in the news at the time the Chinese communists were about to reach the frontier. And my experience of press then had been entirely happy one. In fact, most of my experience of the press then was drinking rum and Coca-Cola in the press club. But more seriously, there was never any problem. I was simply showing them round positions and explaining what we were doing. Later, of course, in the SAS in Malaya, and later on, I met other correspondents. And again, there was no problem because the SAS were doing nothing of which we need have been in the least ashamed. We had no sort of secrets that could have come across the headlines. And there were operational matters that we didn't want to discuss on tactics and that sort of thing. These were not matters that the press were particularly interested in. So, no, I had no problems with the press. The only problems with the press were internal regimental ones when in the same year, 1964, we were also operating in the Radfan area of what was then called the Aden Protectorates. And there, a very gallant action by a troop of the SAS when Captain Edwards was killed. There were terrible and very hurtful and damaging headlines in the press when the news came out that the head of this officer and another soldier had been stuck on pikes in the Yemen. And the publicity that this occasioned brought home to me that there were going to be problems about publicity, though the problems in this case were purely ones of morale to the SAS family. And not ones on security or problems caused tactically. As far as publicity and the SAS were concerned, by the early 60s, by the time we were in Borneo, the SAS was, I'd say, well known in the army. I mean, in the early days in Malaya, there were very many men in the army and officers in the army who'd never heard of the SAS and didn't even know it had been resurrected after the war. By the early 60s, the SAS was quite well known in the army. But as far as the British public were concerned, there had been one or two articles published, usually rather on the semi-sensational side, like with, under headlines like "These Men Are Dangerous" and things like that, with a good deal of writing up of in the super tough image. But by and large, the British public was not aware of the existence of the SAS in the 60s. On the whole, that was probably an advantage. It meant certainly that we didn't get people trying to join the SAS because they thought it was some super elite and they would appear in a film. I can really think I'm afraid of no disadvantages of having that, what's now called a low profile. And it remained that way in the main. Operations took place later, as you know, in Oman, which were not reported in the press at the time. And until the Prince's Gate affair at the Iranian embassy, I would say the SAS was not really known of in British public, to the British public. Perhaps it's worth saying this lack of publicity over the SAS in the 50s and early 60s anyway was a considerable military advantage. For example, it was possible, and I think was considered, that a battalion of the parachute regiment should have gone to the Jebel Akhdar in Oman in 1959 to put down the revolt there. In fact, what actually happened was that a squadron of the 22nd SAS from Malaya was sent to Oman, and it went without any notification to the press or the public, where it joined the only other British unit there, which was an element of the Life Guards. And the operation took place and was completed and finished after a couple of months or so without anybody knowing it had happened. And there must be advantages politically and militarily from having a unit which can be used when it's necessary, without the whole thing being announced in advance.
Yes.
One of the more controversial tactical policies that I introduced in the regiment when it operated in Borneo was the so-called shoot and scoot policy. The reason I coined this particular phrase was because when I considered the enemy in Borneo, my appreciation was that we were liable to meet up with first-class troops, with American-trained special force instructors, either with them or certainly who'd trained them. And obviously, they would react quite differently to the Malayan communist terrorists. At the time when we went to Borneo, we only had two squadrons. And this meant, in round figures, not much more than 100 soldiers. I was anxious that in times of so-called peace, unless I made a very firm impression on the regiment of the necessity for a change in tactics from Malaya, where you simply charged anything that opened fire on you, that ill-considered tactical action might result in the very heavy losses in a single troop by taking a similar action as we had in Malaya. And therefore I emphasized, and probably overemphasized, that when meeting regular Indonesian forces in Borneo, our action should be to open fire on them and to inflict casualties, but not to stay and mix it in a brawl. And I tried to emphasize that SAS, right from World War II, while never afraid of mixing it if they had to, had in general operated on a policy of surprise attack, tremendous impact, and a rapid withdrawal, and hence the shoot and scoot policy. This unfortunately led to one very unfortunate incident where a patrol engaged some Indonesians, and the system then was that after a contact, there was always two RVs, meeting places, for troops if they got dispersed after an action. Every man knew where the first and second RV was. And on this occasion, fire was exchanged, and according to the policy of the time, the patrol then broke up and they met at the RV. Well, one man was missing from the RV, and so the patrol in due course returned to the scene of the action. And the soldier who was missing was found there dead. Now, though in fact he had been mortally wounded at the time, and had they stayed there he would certainly not have survived, the fact remained that a similar situation might occur where a soldier might be wounded and not mortally wounded, and there would be an undue delay before the patrol got back. And the shoot and scoot policy, in retrospect, while tactically it was always sound to emphasize that we should shoot, inflict casualties, and then withdraw at a properly judged moment, it was, in retrospect, I think, mistaken, in that it led, in this particular instance, to something which caused much worry and concern among all troops. And it was modified after that, to the extent that the scene of the action should be returned to as soon as the patrol leader, or whoever had become patrol leader, decided that it was reasonable to do so.